Good afternoon. Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. Today, our guest is Christopher Koch, and Mr. Koch has a new book that's going to be coming out, which is being published by Harcourt Brace, and it's going to be, the publication date is April of 05, and it's being focused on their list, and I've had the pleasure of reading it, and it's an commonly well-written book of first stories. But what we're going to talk about a bit today is Mr. Koch has a story that has been included in the Best American Mystery Stories of 2004, published by Houghton Mifflin, which has been gaining a lot of attention. And one of the reasons I wanted to have Chris on the show today is because I think he's a very good example of a newer writer who has gone through the process of an MFA program, has worked hard at his work, has had some of his stories published, most recently All Through the House in the Best American Mystery Stories. And so I want to kind of explain to the listeners how that process works, and also get to know Chris a little bit as a writer, because I think he's going to have a very, very long and distinguished career. So first of all, Chris, thank you for appearing on the show today.
No problem at all. Thank you for having me.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about your educational background? You were at Miami of Ohio, mm-hmm. and tell us a little bit about Miami of Ohio and kind of the kind of work you did while you were there, and then how you ended up at the Ohio State MFA program, and in kind of the time frame that took place.
Yeah, I got my undergraduate degree from Ball State University.
Okay.
I wanted to be a secondary English teacher, and right about the time I was doing my student teaching there, it occurred to me that if I went and did high school English teaching, that I would never have any more time again to work on my own fiction, which right about at that time was starting to go to a new place for me. I wanted to spend some time indulging that. So at that point, I didn't even know that one could go on and get an advanced degree in creative writing. Once I found that out, one of my professors clued me into that. I immediately seized on it. And I ended up at Miami almost, I'm not going to say at random, but I just picked some schools' names that had been appealing to me. I just visited the Miami campus and thought it was nice. And at that time, their stipend was pretty generous for writers.
Mm-hmm.
And when they accepted me, I was delighted to go. I also went down there as a really young man. I was, you know, maybe 22 years old then, mm-hmm. and you know, was one of only two people in the program who had come right out of undergrad. So I was kind of, you know, doing a lot of my growing up. At the same time, I was getting used to what a graduate fiction program is like, mm-hmm. what a good writing workshop is like. I was there for 2 years and learned a heck of a lot. Made some really good friends, a strong community of writers, many of whom I still talk to. But to be honest, most of the fiction I did down there was only part of a process of getting me to the stuff that I'm writing now. Only one story that I did at Miami is still one that I think is any good. And in fact, it was part of the original manuscript that I submitted to Harcourt that became the book. It turns out, however, that was the one story they didn't like, and they asked me to trade that out for another one, which ended up becoming abandoned.
Okay.
So I graduated Miami, gosh, it would have been 95 when I was done, and I ended up kicking around working at a used bookstore chain here in town.
Let's go ahead and name it, because it's one of my...
Half-Price Books.
Half-Price Books, one of my favorite places in the world, and I like to give them a plug whenever I can, because I think it's a great, great outfit.
I have many good friends there. They've been really supportive. My fiance still works there. So if you're lucky enough to live in a town with Half-Price Books, go visit them now.
Absolutely.
When the interview's over.
Absolutely.
Shortly. Yeah, I worked in the bookstore for a long time, 6 years actually to the day.
Okay.
since I started. What happened in the meantime, though, was that I was married before, and to a woman I'd met in Miami, and she was very sick. I lost her to bone cancer in October of 1999, and it was after that I had to go and do, you know, what has to happen in a situation like that, which was reevaluate everything.
Mm-hmm.
As it turns out, I the one story that had been any good from Miami, I had been submitting at about the time of my wife's illness really, really becoming dire. And a couple of days, even after finding out that she was terminal, I got a call from Michelle Herman, my thesis advisor now at Ohio State, I had submitted the story to Ohio State's Literary Journal, not knowing anybody over there. And Michelle had called to tell me, hey, you know, it's accepted. You've got your first publication. So that was a pretty clear, you know, arrow to me as to what I needed to be doing while I was putting my head back together after my wife died. And after a year or so more at the bookstore, I decided, you know, I want to do more writing. I don't feel I'm where I need to be yet. Creative writing degrees are such that you can get an MA in writing that I got in Miami and go on to get an MFA, which Ohio State offers. These days, you can even go on and get a PhD in creative writing at certain schools. So I applied to MFA programs. I was convinced I was going to go out west. I thought I was going to end up at University of Utah. Went and visited their campus, thought it was lovely. And in the meantime, I'd gotten to know Michelle via the publication of that story, and had sat in on a workshop of hers. And when it came time to make a decision, I was just too comfortable here in Columbus. I decided to stick around a little bit more. Part of that was not wanting to leave family behind just yet. Part of that was getting to know some of the folks in the program. And obviously, Michelle and I have connected really well in terms of my writing. So that was an easy choice at the end.
When you went to Miami for your MA, what were your expectations going in? Because I think there are a lot of people that write that think, well, what I need to do is go to some type of a master's program and really develop my writing skills. And at Miami, like you say, at a fairly young age, what were you expecting, and what did you get, do you think, by going through the two-year process?
I was expecting the moon, you know, but that's kind of a history of me as a writer. I mean, when I was 15 years old, I was sure that I was going to be, you know, have my first fantasy novel published at any moment, and I guess that sort of optimism has served me well, but in practice, it doesn't really amount to too much very often. So when I went into Miami, I was sure that all I needed to do was polish up a couple stories and start submitting them, and, you know, it would all just fall into place.
Somebody would discover you and call and say, I'm sorry, we haven't found you yet, but...
Absolutely. Any minute. And that wasn't the case. Obviously, what I needed to do was just get some experience, you know, put some years behind me, and start thinking about things the way I would as, you know, a 28-year-old, even as compared to you know, the 22-year-old that I was. What I ended up getting was fantastic. I mean, the people at Miami, like the people at Ohio State, are really solid instructors and writers, and. So the workshop setting itself was great. I had my stories looked at in ways that they'd never been looked at before, even with some strong undergraduate classes and teachers. I was made to think about the reasons why I write. Both programs have had instructors who are really good at making students examine their own psychologies and sort of think about, you know, why is it that I always gravitate towards these topics? Why is it, you know, what story is it that the writer keeps telling over and over again? Mm-hmm. Because we all tend to do that.
Right.
More than that, I mean, any writing program that's good, I think, that accepts good students and solid citizens can provide, I think, the most important thing that MFA and MA programs provide, which is community.
Yes.
As an undergraduate writer, I knew a couple of other people who were trying to do what I did, and a lot of folks who were writing, you know, the requisite really bad poetry. And
Sure.
But... to be in a room with 12 people who are as serious about writing as you are, and to have them, you know, these really intense, smart, intelligent readers focus on your own work, and have them available to call at 2 in the morning when you read something that's really good, or when you're stuck, or even just to go out and socialize with and know that everybody at the table is crazy in the same particular way. Right. I mean, that's invaluable.
What type of reading did they encourage you to do?
Just about everything. That was the time I first read Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried, which is a book that you and I have discussed before, but which is, at the time I read it, was exactly what I needed to read.
Yeah.
It showed me that fiction could do 100 other things that I'd never considered it able to do.
Right.
And that was typical of a lot of things. You know, I read Toni Morrison for the first time when I was down there. I read Gabriel Garcia Marquez for the first time when I was down there.
One of my favorites.
Yeah, and just Cormac McCarthy.
Yes.
All the Pretty Horses was out then, so that was the book that we were all trading back and forth.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was good too.
Because reading was an important part of the program.
Yes.
Okay, because I think if you're a listener and you're thinking about looking at programs, I think that it's just my personal opinion that reading has to be a very important part of a writer's development, because Stephen King, in his book on writing, which I think is a fabulous 350-page book on the concept of writing, that's one of the things he says is, if you want to learn how to write, you'd better be a reader too.
Oh yeah, yeah. They're two halves of a whole.
Yeah,
the one is inseparable from the other.
Exactly. I'm very sorry to hear about the loss of your wife. That had to be a traumatic thing. Was there a period of time where you said, "I'm just going to throw in a towel on a writing thing. I'm going to find something different to do," or did that just strengthen your resolve to write?
In the end, it strengthened my resolve. Oddly enough, the period where I thought about not writing was when I was happily married.
Really?
Happily cohabiting and then happily married. Yeah, it was. There are 10,000 reasons not to write. A few that are specific to the writer as to why one should write, and you're going to have a hard time doing it unless you can find those reasons and hew closely to them and really make that pact with yourself that I'm going to do this no matter the discomfort,
yeah.
No matter the time,
yeah.
No matter the financial struggle,
yeah.
Because all those things will happen.
Yes.
And it turned out I was in a job at the bookstore that I liked. I was mm-hmm. working with people I liked. I had books everywhere.
Yeah.
For the first time in my life, I was making enough money to pay my bills.
Right.
And I was living with a wonderful person. And it's easy at that point to sit down and watch, shows about otters on Animal Planet and,
right.
and laugh and point than
right.
it is to, go hide in the room for 3 hours and bang my head against the table. So. When I decided to go back and get the MFA, that was kind of my pact to myself that I'm gonna take the time. I'm gonna set aside the job. I'm gonna set aside that salary. I'm gonna go and be poor and concentrate and mm-hmm. see what I can see. And if after 3 more years of this I'm still no closer, then fine. I'll find something else to do. But it seemed to me that I still had more to learn. I still had stories to tell, and I just knew that I was going to have to deal with what had happened to me with Joellen dying in print sooner or later.
Yeah.
And so why not go with these wonderful people I had just met with this program that's really great. And as it turns out, that was the best decision that I've probably ever made.
Good. And I think you have to learn how to live with rejection too. And some people, writers tend to be sensitive sorts. And the amount of rejection that a writer is going to get is—I don't know what the percentage is, but it's got to be 99% or something like that. And you really do have to learn how to open up the mail and see that you've been rejected, and then go back to the desk and try to do your best work again. And it can be a real struggle.
It is. That's another thing I should say that graduate programs do is they teach a writer to absorb criticism, selectively and well. Because you're going to hear all sorts of criticism. You're going to have people who just don't like your work, no matter what it is.
Right.
And
right.
Sitting at a workshop table and confronting that.
Yeah.
And I should stress that in both programs I've been to, this wasn't like, strong confrontation.
Right.
Or, people yelling and screaming at each other.
Right.
It's all constructive criticism. But if you're not used to constructive criticism, it can still feel terrible.
Yeah.
And so if you can sit through a couple of workshops and hear 15 people tear apart your story, and three of them are going to love it, three of them are going to hate it, the rest of them are indifferent or think it should be different, then you're prepared for the mail. You're prepared to do what I did with my first story, which was to see it rejected 12 times before getting it accepted at Ohio State.
Yeah.
And incidentally, that was a 3-year process too. So if you've got a story that you love, you're going to have to spend years trying to get it in
right.
front of somebody.
Exactly.
And unless you're lucky enough to have an agent or you're going to put it
right.
into a book. And quite frankly, that doesn't happen as often as it probably
right.
ought to.
Exactly. And I think Stephen King does a great job about describing that rejection process, too, in his book on writing. And Andre Debuse, who, as most listeners know, is one of my favorite writers.
And mine, too.
And yours, too.
Yeah.
He wrote me a letter one time, and he said, if we worry about who's going to publish our work, we lose hope to an abstraction.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember reading that and saying, he's absolutely right. I mean, if you sit down to write, and you're more worried about who's going to publish this story than you are about the story that you're writing, then you're probably in it for the wrong reason.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'm struck every time I go to a a big new bookstore and go to the writing instruction section or the writing self-help section, mm-hmm. And seeing all these books about, you know, how to write for this market and how to write for that market. And there just seems to be this focus on, you know, publish a short story at whatever cost, you know, and at whatever speed you can, rather than trying to write the best short story you can about the things that are most important to you and seeing what happens later.
Yeah.
Certainly there's a market in this country for, you know, for art that fills a particular niche or genre need, but the best genre writing I've seen is intensely personal. You can tell that it's... Yeah. Lee K. Abbott, who's one of my instructors.
One of my favorite writers, too.
Yeah, terrific writer, terrific guy.
Yeah.
What he tells us in workshop is that writing ought to cost you more than time.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't, you know, that's just it. What are you doing it for?
Yeah, and Lee is, I think, when it comes to the short story form, I think he's a master at it. I love What Places at Noon, I think, are... I hope I've got the title correctly. If you're listening, mm-hmm. but he's just, you read a Lee Abbott story and you're moved by it. I mean, the characters in there are so real.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know how he does it.
He had a story that was out just a couple of years ago in Georgia Review, I believe it was, called One of Star Wars, One of Doom. Yeah, I think that's the title, which was Lee's take on a Columbine High School like situation.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just one of the very finest stories I've ever read, and mm-hmm. just completely. I mean, you sit when it's done and you stare at the wall for a while,
yeah.
Because he's got that sort of impact.
Yeah, yeah. And he's a great writer.
Great writer. He speaks the same way he writes.
Yeah, and you know, with Lee, sometimes people don't get his sense of humor. Lee's a very funny guy, and sometimes people sit down and they'll read stories, and they lose track of the fact that sometimes writers have a sense of humor and they're trying to make you laugh, or they're trying to show you maybe an absurd side to something. Mm-hmm. And sometimes as readers, we're so serious about what we read.
Yeah.
And Lee has some very funny things in his stories.
Yes, he does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Michelle Herman has been your thesis advisor, correct?
Thesis advisor, mentor. You know, it started when she, you know, plucked my story out of the slush pile at Ohio State Journal, called the Journal.
Yeah.
And ever since then, I mean, she's always had, I think, the first and best read on my writing.
Good.
And in fact, we share an agent now. Once I got enough stories together, Michelle said, "Why don't you show this to Marion, our agent, and see what she thinks about it?" And that's how I've got a book deal now.
Good. Now, believe or agree with the idea that probably beginning writers should start writing short stories and not master the short story form, but learn how to tell stories through short stories versus trying to write a novel as their first attempt at writing?
That's a very difficult question
to
answer.
Yes.
If you are in a writing program, you're almost certainly going to work with short stories.
Okay.
Because you meet at a weekly workshop, it's very difficult to workshop parts of a novel, especially as one is writing it. So it just lends itself to short work.
Yeah.
And I think the fiction market has seen more and more collections from first-time authors.
Yes.
That I think reflects the fact that there are a lot of people coming out of MFA programs,
right.
And this is what they have to show for their time.
Right.
That said, short story collections don't sell as well as novels,
right.
Both to publishers and to audiences.
Right.
Most writers I know think of the novel as the primary battleground for their literary art. You know, certainly it's something that I've been, you know, advised and personally would like to get started and get done as soon as possible, to go from this book of stories into a longer work. That said, and certainly my five favorite authors right now is Alice Munro.
Mm-hmm. I love Alice Munro,
you know, who works exclusively in short stories.
Yeah.
And somebody like Lee, who works exclusively in short stories. I mean, I'm not going to stand back and say these people are not any less of the figures they are because they haven't written, you know, 500 page opuses.
I mean, Raymond Carver wrote short stories. Andre Debuse.
Yeah.
You know. But it's almost like you almost have to wear it as a badge of honor, almost, because you know that the publishers are dangling large checks in front of them, saying, you know, write the novel, you know, mm-hmm. because we can sell more copies of it. So, you know, that being said, you had a little bit of a different experience with. Well, first of all, let's talk about the Best American Mystery Stories
sure.
of 2004. Was it your agent that submitted this? It was in the Gettysburg Review.
It was in the Gettysburg Review, thanks to Lee Abbott, who took it there himself. That was a story I'd done for his workshop, and which Lee was kind enough to explain to me once I turned it in. I thought that story was a miserable failure and didn't make any sense to anyone. And after about 10 minutes in workshop, this was my first time getting workshop by Lee also. Lee, while very funny, as we've established, is also a very formidable figure to people coming into the writing program.
Sure.
There are these sort of, you know, shadowy stories lurking around about, you know, Lee laying into people, and he cares.
He cares about writing.
He really does. And if
and
you're
golf.
Not... And golf. I don't know what he's like on the golf course, but if you're not devoting yourself to the story in front of you, then Lee will let you know about it. And this, you know, this story is formally very different.
Yes.
It's told backwards. You know, it shifting point of view. And I wasn't sure how he was going to take it. And it was to my great shock and pleasure to find out that he liked it. He liked it a lot. And so he bugged me for months after that workshop to revise the story the way he had advised and to submit it. And when I was still dragging my feet, finally he got angry at me and said, well, I'm going to go do a reading at Gettysburg College and just give me the damn story and I'll give it to them and, you know, it'll be submitted. And so that's what happened, and they ended up taking it. The way it ended up in Best American Mysteries was I actually got contacted by Nat Sobel, the agent,
Otto Panzer's agent.
The agent to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Nat is one of the few agents who reads literary journals regularly.
Mm-hmm.
He's always on the lookout for new people. Mm-hmm. He'd actually contacted me years ago about the story that appeared in the journal.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and said, yeah, you know, if you ever get a collection or a novel together, give me a call. And as it turned out, you know, I went through Michelle's agent first, but.
Yeah.
Nat, he contacted me again after this story, you know, said, hey, are you represented? Do you have something going on? And I told him I was, and he said, well, I think it's a terrific story. I'm going to show it to Otto Penzler. Hope you don't mind. I'm like, no.
Right. Yeah, no. Twist my arm. Yeah.
Great, Nat, thank you. Yeah. So that's what he did, and Otto got in touch with me shortly thereafter to say, we want to use this. And I've since talked to Otto a couple of times. He's been nice enough to blurb the cover of the story collection.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good.
He's said some tremendously flattering things, both on your show and elsewhere, which I'm still trying to get over.
Yeah, and it's funny because I've known Otto for 20 years, and he's been a guest on the show. And I'm not being disingenuous when I say this or saying this just because Chris is sitting here across the table from me, but Otto said that it literally was one of the first stories in his career that it took his breath away. And that's very high praise coming from Otto Penzler. And Otto is not a man who says these type of things lightly, because Otto probably reads more particularly mystery type fiction than probably anyone I know. Okay, Joyce Carol Oates, I think, has him beat from what he tells me. But but Otto knows it well, and so that was a real coup for you to get in that collection. Now, we're in trouble, which is I'm looking at the galleys at now. What was the process in terms of getting in Best American Mystery Stories, and then the collection We're in Trouble? How did that work out?
I think at the time Otto called me, We're in Trouble had already been accepted.
Okay.
It's the odd thing was at the time I got offered a contract from Harcourt for this book, only two of the stories that were in it had been accepted for publication at journals, which is kind of strange.
Which
and
is
backwards.
Very for people that aren't aware of the publishing business. That's very very rare.
Yeah, it's a lot of my stories are really long. There are two or three in that book that are approaching 50 pages in manuscript length. One that's longer than that. They're not quite novellas.
Yeah.
But I do tend to work in this sort of twilight zone of length where it's difficult for me to get a story of this size published in some journals. That's why I was surprised when Gettysburg Review took all through the house, because it's a very long story. So I had been submitting some of these things by the time the book was taken, but hadn't had much luck. And I've actually had a lot more luck since then, because now I can, you know, write to journals and say, hey, my book's getting published. You know, we're trying to fit it in. We have this much time. And that's been much more helpful. But so at the time, I think All Through the House had been accepted, but was forthcoming in Gettysburg Review. And it's been a long gestation for We're in Trouble. It was accepted last summer, and it's going to be probably a year and a half between getting the contract and the book appearing.
Yeah.
So there's been some time.
Yeah.
But actually, I'm I couldn't be happier with the way things have turned out, because now, you know, since All of the House is getting some attention in Best American Mystery Stories, my hope is that, you know, people who pick up Best American Mystery Stories are going to be more inclined than to, you know, look for the book when it appears.
Yeah, I think that could end up being very serendipitous, because I know Harcourt, they're very excited about the book, and I know it's one of their featured titles, so congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Now, so now you've not only do you have the book of stories coming out, you have some foreign publications. You've sold the rights to some foreign countries.
Yeah, actually, this would be the time to mention that one of the people who has been kind of instrumental in all of this happening was the writer Nick Hornby. Nick was here as a visiting instructor my first year at Ohio State, and took a look at a couple of the stories that I was working on that are now in the book, and liked them quite a bit. And the reason that I have a collection of stories that I work towards a cohesive whole that way is because on his way out of the country, Nick mentioned to his publishers in New York, Penguin, that, you know, that they ought to ask after me. And so a few weeks after he left, they did call and say, hey, you know, Nick says to send stuff along. So at that point, I only had four or five stories that I thought were any good, and in retrospect, it wasn't quite that many. But so I put something together on, you know, discussion with all the faculty, and sent it out and said, this is what I'm working on. I'm scrambling at this moment to get a full collection, and should have that done within a few months. And that really, you know, it was a tremendous kick in the pants for me to work a lot faster at getting a collection together. Otherwise, I might not have done it until, you know, I left.
Well, a tremendous validation as a writer too, to have Nick Hornby be so taken with your work.
Yeah, yeah, I was really blown away by that. Yeah. And Nick has continued to you know, be very helpful. One of the things he did, in fact, was, I mean, Penguin ended up not taking a pass on the stuff I sent them. And that's fine. It wasn't as you know, good as it needed to be, but shortly, you know, then thereafter, I did get this collection together and have it available to show to an agent, and, you know, start this process sort of the traditional way. But once it was taken by Harcourt, Nick managed to mention to his publishers in Britain, Penguin UK, you know, that, well, now there's this book out from Harcourt, and, you know, you ought to look at seeing if you can get the rights for England. And in fact, that's what happened. And from there, we've had a little bit, you know, kind of a chain reaction happening. The Italian publisher Guanda is gonna do it. They also publish Nick stuff. Goldman in Germany is doing it. I can't pronounce French very well, but I think it's Albin Michel is doing it in France.
Okay.
So I, you know, the way all this happens is, you know, I don't want to be disingenuous about the book, because I'm very proud of it.
Yes.
But I think once a certain amount of, you know, advanced buzz gets in the air too, that makes this, you know, very helpful.
No question.
Yeah.
Are there times when you wake up in the morning sometimes and go, is this really happening to me? Or is it,
yeah, just about every
day. Am I in a Stephen King story, you know, and something's going to happen somewhere?
I have pulled over on the side of the road a couple of times in the last year and tried to, you know, bop myself in the head a couple of times. Last summer before this book sold, and I was sitting in my room wondering if anybody would ever care.
Yeah,
this was not the the outcome that I imagined.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Let's talk about. I know that you're in the process of working on a novel, or is it a novel, or is it two novels?
I have been working on two different novels.
Okay.
One of them was going to be, and may still be, an expansion of the story Solos in the book We're in Trouble.
Which I love. I love that story.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I've been working on that group of characters now for 2 or 3 years.
I could see how that story could become a novel fairly, not easily, but I mean, when you read it, there's still a lot of... you still care very much about the characters, and you do want to know what is going to happen, you know, because, not to give anything about the story away, but it becomes fairly complicated, and it's told, I think, very artfully about how love happens and emerges sometimes in the oddest of places, and when it's very inconvenient. And so what I could see how you could take that story and make a novel of it, and I think it would make a very good novel.
Well, that's my hope.
Yeah.
So far, it has not made a very good novel, which is why I'm a little frustrated, and I'm going to set it aside for a while. The other reason is that it's a really research-intensive project.
Yeah.
My characters are not U.S. citizens. One of them is a mountaineer. a very serious mountaineer, and that's not something that.
And there is some, there is some mountaineering in the story, but it's at a very cursory level compared to what you would have to have him do in the novel.
Right. Yeah, that was my clever solution, was to tell the story from the point of view of somebody who was also astonished by the fact that this person could go and do death-defying things.
Yeah.
But I do come down on the side that that's a little bit more of a risky undertaking than I want to get into. So I still have to solve the problem of how to write about this person doing a thing that I myself would not, not in a million years, try to do.
Yeah.
So I do hope to get over it. The story is set in Slovenia. The novel would be set in Slovenia and Nepal. I would like to see those places.
Yes.
And trying to do that in the next couple of years, especially I'm going to start teaching in January at the University of Nevada, Reno. And that's, you know, getting away to do this sort of research. You know, it all strikes me as a project maybe to complete in 5 years instead of the next two.
Yeah.
The project I'm excited about now is going to be, it's set around a town much like the one I lived in for a while in Colorado when I was a boy, Cripple Creek, Colorado.
I love that name.
Oh, Cripple Creek is a fantastic place.
It's an old band song, so I mean, you know, which is one of my favorite bands of all time. So
yeah, you and me both. Uh-huh. It's fantastic. Cripple Creek at the turn of the last century, I should say now, was one of the biggest gold camps in the world. Had a population around 50,000, and was pulling hundreds of millions of dollars worth of gold and silver out of the ground. And these days, or at least the time when I lived there, it was a town of about 600 people. You know, and all this history was just sort of laying around in the ground. We lived next door to two abandoned houses that had been uninhabited for decades. There are ghosts and ghost stories everywhere, just gaping holes in the ground, stories of gunfights. Jack Dempsey fought there when he was a young man.
Oh, really?
Groucho Marx was a bellhop. So, I mean, it's just, it really, if a novel can't happen out of all those elements, and I think it can, I would like to do sort of a historical survey of a town much like it. Not Cripple Creek itself, but one.
Well, it sounds like that's something that you can work on while you're teaching. Excuse me, in writing, and perhaps the other one takes a little longer to come to fruition. But
It's also, this is I need to take a little bit of a break, I think, from some of the stuff I'm working on in We're in Trouble. The expansion of the story Solos is very much of a piece, tonally and thematically with this book. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to go and try something else for a little while.
Sure. Tell us a little bit about Reno. You're going out in January, is it?
That's right.
And tell us a bit about how that happened. Did the publication of the book and the stories, was that instrumental in you getting the position out there?
Yeah. That's the way it is with getting jobs teaching creative writing. Unless you've got a significant track record of publication, that's almost always the phrase that they use in the job listing, you're not going to get considered for something like that.
Right.
And having a book and being able to say I've got a book coming out is a gateway to some serious consideration for these jobs.
Yeah.
We didn't know. That said, it's I've heard differing opinions as to how hard it is to get a position, mm-hmm. and was led to believe that it was going to be as much of a struggle as getting a book taken in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was really, really gratified to to meet these good folks at Nevada and find out about their school and the way they do things, and then to get offered the job. As I said earlier, I wanted to get out west for a long time.
Yeah.
I lived in Colorado when I was a boy. I wanted to go to Utah. And a chance now to go and live near the mountains, live in a really beautiful city. Reno is just a spectacular place.
Yeah.
And my fiance and I are both really excited to get out there and get settled and get started.
I'm excited for you. And congratulations on your engagement.
Thank you. That's about a month old now.
A month old now. Wonderful. That's wonderful. That's... your fiance, she works, as you were mentioned, she works at Half Price Books. Does she like to write at all, or is she more of a reader?
She keeps a bunch of journals.
Okay.
She reads constantly.
Okay.
I have asked her if she's done some writing, and she has said that yes, she has.
Uh-huh.
But as to whether I'll ever see any of that, I don't know.
Yeah.
She's going to be, I'm imagining right now what she's going to look like listening to this part of the interview. So I don't know. We'll see if she shows me something someday.
Yeah.
She's a very private person.
I understand.
I should say that.
Yeah,
so.
as my wife is too. Is she your first reader?
You know, it's strange. She doesn't particularly care for the stories I do.
Okay.
She reads some terrific stuff, but I think she. I mean, this is a sad book.
Yes, it is.
It's a dark book in a lot of places,
it
and
is.
I think she prefers. stuff with a little bit more uplift.
I can understand that. That makes perfect sense.
I also said a really tragic story in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, which is her favorite place on earth, and she's not likely to forgive me for for tinging that place for her.
But you know, I think for a writer though, It's a very important thing to have separate lives, like you say. Sometimes you can get so engrossed in the stories you're writing or something, and it's a great thing to be able to turn the computer off and go out and have another life completely separate from life.
It doesn't bother me at all, and that's a thing that would have surprised me a great deal if you'd asked me when I was 18 years old.
Yeah.
You know, I would have set a requirement for, you know, being anywhere near me was to deal with that.
And like every single thing you wrote.
Yeah, praise my way. And
right.
You know, that's unreasonable. I respect Stephanie a lot more for telling me no, that, you know, she'll stand back and say, yeah, objectively, I can see that it's good.
Yeah.
You know, I think you're a good writer, but
just
the story makes me feel bad, and I don't like that. So, that's fine.
Well, you know, I was talking to Thomas Cook the other night, and this is when I was talking with Horton Foote, and he said sometimes for writers humility is a very good thing, that he had written some things sometimes that he thought were just absolutely fabulous, and when they didn't get that type of reception, it was a very he learned a lesson in humility, and I thought to myself, if Horton Foote feels that way. Okay, that must be a pretty good thing for writers in general, then, to have that experience.
Absolutely, it's part and parcel of the whole process I've gone through in getting my degrees anyway.
Yeah.
Is that I'm very good friends with people who are able to look me in the eye and say, I think this story failed.
Yeah.
I don't think you're doing what you think you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, look at this page. What are you thinking?
Yeah.
And that's that's good. I mean, yeah. The writer Bob Chakotchis came to visit Miami of Ohio many years ago.
Great writer.
Yeah, he is. And he said a very smart thing, which is that good criticism is a luxury. Mm-hmm. Not many people are going to offer you good criticism.
Yeah.
There's going to be members of your family who are going to love what you do no matter what you do.
Right.
There are going to be people who dislike what you do and won't be able to tell you that.
Yeah.
But whether somebody enjoys what you do or not, the most helpful thing for a writer is to have that group of people who can explain to you why.
Yeah.
And be blunt,
yeah.
Because you're not going to get that from anybody, and you'd rather get it before the editors see it than afterwards.
Right. Jim Harrison said one time that there's more danger in reading good reviews than there is in reading bad ones.
I think so.
Yeah,
I think so.
Because if everybody says you're great, then you might have a tendency to actually start believing that. And let's face it, everything that a writer writes is not great.
Yeah, I would say the majority, at least, for me, the majority of what I do is not worthy of getting sent out. I have to produce, 2 to 3 bad things for every one thing that I'm
sure.
I'm happy
Stephen
with.
King calls it killing your darling. Sometimes you write something and you think, boy, this is just so good. I mean,
Yeah.
And sometimes you just have to finally just say, you know what? I had to write that, but evidently nobody needs to read it, or and you learn something from it, and you. You toss it in the trash can, and you go on, and that's life.
I'm finding out I've got about there needs to be a year period between my first draft of something and subsequent drafts.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's
so you write the first draft and then you kind of put it away for a while and then.
I can do it faster, but it's most helpful for me if I can get a year's distance.
Okay.
Let's say 6 months to a year's distance,
okay.
And it's been a real pain in the butt realizing that and getting enough. Projects in the air that I always have something that I can be working on.
Yeah. Do you have any concerns about going out to Reno and changing hats now and becoming the guru who has the books out in publication now and the ones that people are looking to now for guidance? How's that feel going from being a student to a professor?
It's another complicated feeling. Overall, I feel really good about it.
Yeah.
One of the nice things about Ohio State is that they allow their students to teach introductory workshops as part of the deal of being a graduate student. So I've taught a few sections now of a fiction workshop, and it was literally after teaching the first class of the first fiction workshop I had that I was just walking home, feet not even touching the ground. I'd lectured for 2 hours, hadn't even seen stories yet, but this was me getting to talk about the subject I love most. And, it was that point that I said to myself, if this works out, if this is the career that I end up getting, great.
Good.
Great. And I've not backed away from that.
Good.
I just love talking with students about their fiction. They're so involved with it in a way that they're not always in other college classes.
And one of the things I'm so glad to hear you talk about, one of the things that I do try to talk about is that I hope that young writers do not become so obsessed with publication that they quit writing, because if it takes a certain maturity level, it takes life experiences, it takes, I've told my wife before, I said it's like a painter does not sit down with a canvas and paint and expect to see a masterpiece. Okay. But some young writers think that you should be able to sit down and write something and it should be a masterpiece, not knowing that that painters throw away 100 or 1,000 of their canvases before they ever approach anything which is approaching art.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And a lesson that I had to learn too is that even the books and the works that I think of as masterpieces, they're all flawed.
Sure.
They're all, in some cases, deeply flawed.
Yeah.
And it never would have occurred to me to think that when I was a beginning writer.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that the things I loved were absolutely perfect. And the better I've gotten at being a critic, mm-hmm. the better I've gotten at looking at my classmates' stuff on my own, I can see that, I don't know, maybe the things they carried is a perfect masterpiece. But I'll look at something like The Lord of the Rings, which is a book that meant everything to me when I was mm-hmm. a boy, and which mm-hmm. I still am very close to. I mean, it's a long ways away from a perfect book.
Right.
The movies they've made from it are not perfect movies.
Right.
And yet, they've meant as much to me as just about anything I've read or seen in the past few years. I've really had a chance to go in and sort of live a part of my life over again and to think new things.
Yeah.
And, I think they are timeless, works that have been made. But that's sometimes a struggle to convince my students of, that the things they love, are they have problems. And we have to look at those problems.
Yeah.
And you can love them for their problems, and that the problems make interesting sort of reflections within the work. But
and, with Tim O'Brien, who you and I have talked to, I think is one of the finest writers writing today. I might be mistaken on this, but I don't think I am. I don't think with The Things They Carried, but I think within The Lake of the Woods, he continued revising that novel after it came out in hardcover. He revised it again before it came out in paperback.
I've read that somewhere else about him too, that even with between printings of his books, he will sometimes insist on going in and changing punctuation or word choices.
Yes, yes. Which kind of reminds me, and we'll end the interview here shortly, but Tennessee Williams, when he had his first story published in the New Yorker, Gore Vidal went over to talk to him, and he to congratulate him on his story being in the New Yorker, and Gore Vidal said, what are you working on? And he said, well, I'm working on this story. And he goes, well, that's the one that was just in the New Yorker. He said, yes, of course, it's not finished. And a lot of writers are like that, I've even heard of writers that have taken the books that they've written and before they've died, they've gone back and they've rewritten them again the way they wanted them to be. So revision can become an obsession.
It down that path can lie madness.
Yes.
You got to be careful. I mean, I'll go back and repeat too. I might still be revising All Through the House if not for somebody like Lee Abbott who would just yank it from my hands. That's another thing I think that all good writers need is somebody who can eventually just slap you on the back of the head and say, it's good enough.
It's good enough. It's done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like it. Stop.
Yeah.
And that's valuable.
And part of the thing, too, is that as for selfish reasons, I think readers and writers want you to produce more work, too. And and when a story reaches a point where it's publishable and it's good, then it's time to move on and write something else so that we can enjoy reading that.
That's a good thing to think. I don't know. It's the world of fear and pain that personally I live in with my writing is that's hard to understand, but it's nice to hear.
Yeah. Chris, thank you so much for appearing on the show, and we're going to stay in touch with you when the book is published in April. I think, didn't you say you were coming back?
That's my understanding now, is that they're going to have me come back out here and do a reading.
Okay. Well, maybe then maybe we can get together again,
absolutely.
Get caught up on what you're doing out in Reno and how that's going. And I'm just so happy for you that things are turning out the way they are for you, because I really do believe you deserve it. I've read a lot of fiction, and you're a very fine writer.
Thanks, Casey. I really appreciate that.
Yeah.